At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Welcome back, folks, to another episode of Positively Trek and the penultimate episode of Season 3. I love that word, penultimate. So whenever I get to use it, I love to throw it in there. So we are talking about another episode of Strange New Worlds this week, Terrarium. But of course, I cannot do that alone. So with me is my wonderful co-host, Barry DeFord. Barry, welcome back to talking about another Strange New Worlds episode. Precious few of them left.
Agree.
Yeah. Nice. I think there are enough episodes in a typical season of Strange New Worlds.
Disagree.
Yeah, I actually disagree with that as well. Absolutely.
There we go. That's my episode specific. We've got a bit of a running thing going now, so we might as well keep it going, right?
I like it. Yeah. Ooh, I'm curious what the next one will be. Anyway.
Not too sure. Other than tears of being like, there's only 2 cents left.
It's over.
Yeah, not happy about that.
No, for sure. Well, we're not quite there yet. We are talking about the second last episode of the season, Terrarium, the shortest episode title of the season. And we're going to talk about that title in a couple different contexts because it's an interesting one.
Mm-hmm.
But to start out with, without really getting into the whole plot of the thing yet, I'm thrilled because it's an Erica Ortegas episode. Finally, we get an Erica Ortegas episode. We kind of had one last year a little bit where everyone loses their memory. She had a significant plot there. But this one is unabashedly 100% an Erica Ortegas episode, and I am here for it.
Yeah, she steals the show in the first episode of the season, right? Mm-hmm. I fly the ship, that sort of thing. And her heroics and everything. But yeah, no, we don't actually get a full-on Erica Ortegas episode, which I do have to say, she is sort of the, you know, she's the fun, she's the fly girl, she's got the attitude, all that sort of stuff. So I do quite enjoy her character, and I like it when they give her things to do.
Mm-hmm. And this episode in particular, she really like carries it herself in a lot of the scenes because she is acting against a fair, for the most part, nonverbal co-star. And so we're hearing her voice a lot, and she's kind of having to carry scenes a lot, and yeah. She's up for it. I think she really does well in this.
It actually reminds me a little bit of Mark Hamill's performance in Empire Strikes Back, when it's him and a puppet.
Right.
And that's it. So again, we've got Melissa Navia, who is on a set with a puppet, and that's it. So I think, I think she definitely does a really good job of, A, making that puppet actually look like it's a real creature who's actually, like, doing things and everything like that, and she interacts with it really, really well.
One thing I wanted to ask, and this is kind of tongue-in-cheek, this is based on a comment I saw online, how do we feel about the fact that her brother, Beto Ortegas, got an episode before Erica? Not really, but it was kind of an amusing comment that I saw that, like,
I mean, better late than never, I guess. Mm-hmm. I know we've had some pretty Uhura-heavy episodes, and I've really enjoyed that. Obviously, the Spock-Lon love tryst has been interesting as well. I feel like as the series has gone on, Nurse Chapel hasn't been quite as, you know, center stage, but that's kind of as things have moved forward.
In fact, I don't think she's in this episode at all.
I don't remember seeing her with my eyes. Nope.
Yeah.
Nope. And then Pike's kind of orbited a lot of things, and, you know, I think obviously we have seen enough of him, but it's nice to get that sort of singular ensemble cast member getting their heyday. So yeah, giving Melissa Navia lots to do is always wonderful.
Mm-hmm.
And definitely. Yeah, sure, her brother gets it first, but I feel like we're not going to see a lot of him in the future. At least I'm not convinced we will. So might as well.
Yeah, for sure. And that's kind of tongue in cheek. That's not really his episode. It was just, I thought that was kind of funny. I want to talk just for a second about my expectations for this episode. I had a mini kind of theory about it before we knew anything about it. And it was proved to not be the case. I basically saw the title. I saw the title Terrarium. And I was like, I've heard the word terrarium twice in the last year. And in both of those cases, it was as revealed as the title of this episode. And in the episode Wedding Bell Blues, the second episode of the season, where Rhys Darby's character shrinks Spock down and says, oh, look, I've got my own little Vulcan terrarium. And I was like, oh, is that like a little verbal clue that this is going to be the return of Rhys Darby's Trelane-esque character? And unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know, wherever people fall on this, that is not the case. Unfortunately for me, because I thought like, oh, maybe I just made the biggest like Hail Mary prediction in the universe. But no such luck.
I mean, it was a good catch and a good false positive. I have my thoughts on why they chose Terrarium, but I think we can talk about it a little bit more after we get through the setup.
Yes, absolutely. So first impressions in this episode, just going by the teaser before the main credits, this feels so much like a TOS episode. I think you and I both kind of made this observation. Mm-hmm. We've got the teaser ending on a typical TOS or really wider Star Trek note with, you know, a shuttle going missing, a crew that has to find Ortegas within a certain period, the kind of bum, bum, bum ending before the credits. And then the whole thing that they have to make this rendezvous to deliver desperately needed medical supplies, which is like a thing that Star Trek has gone to a few times. It's a really great way to give the episode a ticking clock, right? We've seen that in the Galileo 7 with Commissioner Ferris pressuring Kirk to leave to make the rendezvous before he finds his crew that's lost in a shuttle. Mm-hmm. Obsession, where Kirk is fighting this cloud creature, but they also have to make a rendezvous with a ship to deliver, I think, medical supplies in that one as well. So this is a well they go to often, but it's a good one. Like, it felt very Star Trek.
Yeah, I thought that we might do something a little more supernatural, just the way they were kind of playing up this gravimetric weird zone, kind of like a semi-Bermuda Triangle kind of thing. But mm-hmm. I liked Ortegas's callbacks to kind of old sailing ships and seafaring and, you know, talking about flying into a hurricane and stuff like that. It gave some really good visuals, especially for the fact that she was flying blind, right? There wasn't actually any special effects inside of the cockpit, except for a very sort of simplistic monitor, which again kind of harkens itself back to the more 1960s feel of things. I feel like less is more sometimes, and they did a good job. There has been a lot of really tasty visuals in this entire series. Even since the start of Discovery, I found that a lot of the visuals and sounds have just been so absolutely delicious to take in. But the less is more sort of aspect of this, actually, I quite liked. We didn't actually see the shuttle bouncing around. It was all mostly diagnostic equipment showing what was happening, which ultimately is what you would have actually seen. So as you and I like, it's people looking at screens doing their jobs. And for whatever reason, that really gets me excited. So yeah, I liked that.
Yeah. No, absolutely. The one that struck me especially was the monitor on Uhura's console, mm-hmm. where it shows the little blip that's Ortega's shuttle, and it just boop, disappears into the middle. And like the tension that creates is so good.
Yeah.
I was listening to another podcast, Realms Unknown, that talks about science fiction and stuff. And they were talking about the trope that sci-fi goes to a lot, which is like the life sign indicator, right? Yeah. Where you want to show a lot of deaths happening, but you're not actually showing them on screen. You've got your teams, right? And you've got the one colored blips and they're moving one way, and then the enemy blips are moving the other way. And as they get closer, your blips start disappearing and you're like, ah, no. Yeah. Like, it's so good at building that tension and on a budget too.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, Ridley Scott did that with Alien, right? That was
exactly,
actually, for me, one of the scariest scenes in that movie was just watching those two flashing lights getting closer and closer.
Yeah.
You know? Blech.
It's so good. It's really good. Absolutely. So yeah, Erica ends up on the wrong side of a surprise wormhole, I guess. And yeah, she crashes on this moon of a gas giant. And she soon finds out that its long elliptical orbit will bring it into contact with the gas giant's atmosphere, which will surely kill her. And the crew of the Enterprise, I like that they play with this throughout the episode too, is they don't know if she's alive or dead. Mm-hmm. They're trying to ascertain that. We have one crew member in the form of Uhura who's, you know, desperate to find her friend, and a bunch of the rest of the crew who are being very pragmatic and saying, like, you need to prepare for the fact that she might not be alive.
So. Yeah. The visuals here as well, watching her on this moon, and just sort of like the chaotic look, right? Like, this isn't I don't think it was a fully spherical moon anyways either. And there's just a lot of other kind of bits of debris everywhere. Big gas giant just shredding everything around it. And just the amount that it takes up the horizon, and it's kind of roiling and bubbling and stuff like that. Recently in my classroom, what I like to start my students off with is by looking at Carl Sagan's Pale Blue Dot speech. And that helps kind of shape worldview. And, like, you know, you see this picture of Earth, but it was taken from gas giant Saturn. And a student of mine asked, like, you know, so you could just, like, go right through them, they're just made of gas? And I'm like, well, no, actually, like, the density would actually crush you as you get further in. And they're like, but it's gas, like, how does that work? And it's just, you know, the scope and the scale of things. And I really feel like, just sort of visually, they catch the scale of this gigantic looming planet that you know, kind of uncaringly is just about to swallow this moon up in its weird elliptical orbit. So I enjoyed the visuals quite a bit. You even mentioned a bit about the special effects in the screen that they used on that.
Yeah, so that's something that in previous seasons and in previous episodes I've seen a few complaints about, and I kind of agree. The times when they use the AR wall, is known in some circles as the volume, right? It's this virtual reality wall that they can project anything so that actors can actually act against real visuals rather than, you know, a green screen and somebody with a stick with a ping pong ball or whatever, right? And there are times when you're watching and you're like, this looks like they're on a set with an AR wall.
Yeah.
And I think last season's, actually, Erica Ortega's episode, among the Lotus Eaters, there were a few scenes where it's like, oh, there's a few set pieces and then the scenery. And it's just like, it just didn't quite work for some people. This episode, I feel like they've learned how to use that wall to its full effect, because there were a lot of scenes where it felt way more real than it has in the past. So I think they did a really good job. I'm not sure if it was just the camera angles used or they're really learning how to shoot that wall, I think. There's one scene toward the end where I was like, oh, that didn't quite ring true. But for the most part, this whole episode, it looks really good. And I feel like she's actually in danger. And I'm sure that also has to do with the debris and the industrial fans they're blowing stuff around her with, possibly.
Yeah.
It's the most convincing CG debris I've ever seen.
It's real, no. I would say.
With regards to this planet and what Erica is going through, I really liked the Starfleet survival stuff on display. This is a perennial complaint for Star Trek, is they beam down with, you know, a phaser, a tricorder, and a communicator, and pajamas. Sometimes they bring a flashlight, but not all the time.
Yeah.
But yeah, I loved her, you know, first of all, her rations are all destroyed in a fire in the shuttle. Yeah. But she's able to cobble together a water condenser. You know, we've seen her tinkering with stuff. We know she's good with that. And also, as she mentions, Starfleet Academy Survival 101, right? So
yeah.
I loved these skills on display, building that water condenser. And then later to speak with her companion on this moon, rudimentary translation device that she's able to cobble together from a tricorder. The visuals do such a good job of making this planet look so inhospitable. Mm-hmm. It really does feel like a feat that she was able to survive. So kudos to everybody involved with that.
Yeah, no, I like the way she works on herself, right? She checks herself for injuries. I like mm-hmm. the fact that she was also prepared to take kind of a log for her time, and then that breaks down. Her absolute joy at being able to create water for herself too really reminds me of Tom Hanks making fire during Castaway. I do like that, you know, the MacGyver like thing. And you said you almost heard MacGyver like music when she was doing it.
Sounded like it, yeah. Like, yeah. I mean, I'm not a MacGyver watcher. I just know a few of the little tropes, and it sounded like there was kind of a little sting there. Maybe I don't know. Somebody more familiar with MacGyver might be able to tell me if that's actually the case or if I'm making that up. But
yeah. I guess like the only other thing is like the improbability of the rations being destroyed the way they were. Like I think about myself when I hike, my food always goes in, you know, it's usually double ziplocked in the center of my backpack. So it will be the last thing to be destroyed should things start getting destroyed. But I mean, for the sake of storytelling, the plot armor around it all worked anyways. But I was just a little bit like, oh yeah, come on. You know, now all the rations are gone and stuff. But she needs to get out of the ship. They need to get her out of there. And she has to start eating bugs.
Yeah. And oh my God. Speaking of realistic visual effects. Ugh,
that little squirt that comes out the side.
Oh yeah. No, that was horrific for sure. Well, yeah. So she's making her way across this desolate plain in search of food of some kind. Basically she's solved the water issue. She needs food and she is seeing nothing except eventually this little flash of light on the horizon. And that's where she realizes there's somebody else trapped on this moon with her. And she goes, investigates this place, and soon finds out it is a Gorn. So, oh boy.
Yeah. I like how when they first make contact, right, and that weird centipede is out and or is about to come out, and the Gorn is kind of regarding her, and she is just like, "Just kill me, okay? Like, why are you hesitating? Just kill me, right? That kind of thing." Mm-hmm. You know, I've realized I would probably think my goose was cooked too, pretty quick, but I guess I wasn't surprised by the Gorn's, you know, decision, but at the same, and I kind of had an idea of where it was going to go, but I still think it was played really well, especially by Melissa Navia, right? Like she looked angry, scared, I guess is the best way to put it. Like she knew she was going to die and she had that kind of look in her eye. So
it was the absolute fight or flight. And it could have gone either way.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah, no, that was really good. And I mean, yeah, in some ways, like they're setting it up. Like, I think we've seen enough of this kind of story that like, oh, there's going to be a twist. The Gorn is not going to kill her. And I thought it was interesting and kind of jumping around the episode, though, like it wasn't even a story of two enemies coming together. Like at no point is the Gorn antagonistic towards Ortegas. Like, basically, we find out by the end of the episode, she was lonely. Yeah. Like, she just had never any intention of hurting her or anything. She just was lonely. And I was like, that was amazing. Again, borrowing from the great episodes of Star Trek, like we've seen something like this, Darmok from TNG, Dawn from Enterprise, and both of which borrow a lot from the movie Enemy Mine, right? So,
right.
Yeah, unlikely allies working together, surviving together. But again, with that catch that the Gorn was never intending harm towards Ortegas. Yeah.
It does kind of regard her though, right? When it's holding her, it kind of like does its weird little like face twitch of like, oh, really? You gave me a human. Sweet. Fine. Okay. Freaking meat sack.
Yeah. The other thing, too, is the revelation towards the end that the Gorn understands everything that Ortegas is saying through the whole episode, which casts it in a different light, for sure, once you realize that.
Yeah.
So, like, Gorn's like, okay, go ahead, eat me. And Gorn's like, tosses her aside and kills the thing.
Yeah.
I like that. That's kind of funny that this Gorn's like, no, like, shut up. You racist human. Good Lord.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, also, I mean, she says, you know, you need to know your prey, and it's like, disagree, right? Know your enemy, agree, right? I think, you know, I hate to say this, but I called it, that they would be bringing the Gorn back up later on. And would be returning to the Gorn and doing a little bit more to flesh out their situation. And again, I don't want to necessarily get into the end, but I have some thoughts on that as we move forward in terms of the interactions between the human and the Gorn and the probabilities. I'm not going to say possibilities, the probabilities for what future seasons might be looking at. Because, you know, season two, we start getting the hints of the Gorn. By season three, now it's like pretty much there. And we're ending, you know, penultimately, we're ending on some interesting points as to how the Gorn are going to be treated perhaps in the future.
Yeah. Definitely. The other thing I really liked about Ortegas and this Gorn working together is like the physical survival of it for sure. Like they're able to communicate and work together and problem solve. But also they're both very much hurting emotionally and psychologically, right? Mm-hmm. Ortegas through her experiences earlier this season with the Gorn, and this Gorn, we know, and Ortegas points out that we've seen Gorn in the past destroy damaged Gorn ships, killing all aboard because they're perceived as weak. And this Gorn is horribly injured. She's had those bug things biting at her legs, basically, and she can barely walk. Mm-hmm. And she knows that, like, a rescue is a death sentence, as Ortegas says. So, and a rescue is a death sentence, maybe regardless of who is doing the rescuing. We'll get there. But I do like that there's a line Ortegas says later, like, even if they don't survive, they both know they're not broken anymore.
And agree.
Yeah. I love that. That was so good. A little tears welling in my eyes at that. I'm like, oh, this, I'm very emotionally attached to this puppet.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, those cursed ankle biters, as I like to think of them. This brings up, you know, the kind of quintessential trope of, you know, the enemy's story is a lot like mine, right? And we can translate that back into, you know, different instances in human history when two warring sides wind up in the same spot. You know, like there's countless examples of that when you start realizing, you know, like the 1914 armistice in World War I, when the soldiers decided, you know, screw war, we're going to celebrate Christmas together. And, you know, they find out that they have so much in common. They're all a bunch of farm boys fighting each other for some inbred royalty kind of thing. You know, I think this does open up the humanity of the Gorn, right? I mean, the Gorn are a very hostile species. You know, they do a lot of things that we would consider to be, you know, hegemonic. I mean, they call themselves the Gorn hegemony, right? But at the same time, you know, you're discounting the individual in a lot of cases there and what the individual might be going through specifically. Mm-hmm. So I think, yeah, boiling it down just to this level and using Ortegas, I think, as, you know, as having set her up as having this trauma, I think this can give her the ability to manage that trauma, so long as she's allowed to remember it. But we'll talk about that later.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Also, and this was kind of just a funny moment while we were watching this and the two of them were getting closer and working together better. I did make the comment, you know, still a better love story than Twilight.
It truly is. It truly is. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. That was
an enjoyable piece there. Because, yeah, I mean, I don't know. It's not even two opposites too, right? They're both pilots, I think, was also a good little catch that brings them together. And, you know, finding out that the Gorn is in fact a female Gorn. I don't know how they breed and stuff like that, or what constitutes a female in that respect. But, you know, I mean, that makes sense that, you know, human beings have male and female pilots and stuff like that. Why wouldn't the Gorn?
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
As always, Positively Trek is brought to you by its Patreon supporters, including Joyce Mirren, Brandy Jackala, Christina DeClercq-Zalagi, John Guppy, Out of Memory, Patrick Carlin, and Ricky Long. If you'd like to support the podcast, visit patreon.com/positivelytrek. You can join at any level and enjoy early access to episodes, ad-free episodes, episode shoutouts, executive producer credits, and more. Again, that's patreon.com/positivelytrek. Thank you so much to those of you supporting us. We truly do appreciate it. And now, back to the show. Well, let's leave the two of them on the planetoid for a moment and pop back to the Enterprise, because they are desperately trying to figure out A, if Ortegas is alive, and B, if she is, how to rescue her. And this effort is primarily led by Uhura, who is desperate to find her friend, latching onto every little hint and piece of evidence. You know, when she picks up a transmission, she's like, it's definitely from the other side of the wormhole. And Spock points out there's no way to determine that. Like, we don't know if she sent that before she fell in or whatever. There's no way. And like, we can't tell that. And she's insistent and pushing to keep exploring different avenues of rescue. Again, still running up against that ticking clock that we're reminded a lot by Una, that, you know, there's a red line, and once they hit it, they, you know, there's a pandemic happening on a planet that they have the vaccines for aboard the ship, right? So
yeah, needs of the many.
Yeah, exactly. Classic needs of the many story. Boy, okay. So we're seeing a repeating pattern here, and I have to point it out again. There's ultimately this leads to Uhura coming up with this plan to use the Enterprise rather than probes or shuttles to enter the wormhole and basically wedge it open, because it's starting to shrink and collapse, and look for Ortegas, scan for her that way. And there's a bit of technobabbly numbers here where Pike says, well, the scan resolution has to be above 60%. And she looks down at her pad and it's at 56 or something. And she manually scrubs it up to say 61 and presents, and Pike's like, all right, well, let's go then. So that's disappointing. A very similar, I think, to what Ortegas did that got her in trouble, right? Like nudging the impulse speed up just a little bit, right? It very similar kind of thing. And again, my disappointment comes at the end where Pike's like, oh, I know you fudged the numbers. Breaking the rules, that's new for you, but when it's for the right reasons, that's okay. And I'm like, no, it's not.
Well, and they also really, I don't know, I do have a bit of an issue with the storytelling on the ship. I really liked the duality between Ortegas and the Gorn, but I feel like everything that was happening on the ship, I don't really feel like Uhura had a reason to keep trying so hard, because every single attempt and every single explanation from every other character was, she's gone, she's dead, it's a wormhole, there's no way to see through the other side. Like, there wasn't, you know, oh, but there was a weird little blip, or there was no kind of like, no little trail of rice even. She was just doggedly pushing. I feel like if, you know, they would have found like bits of Ortegas's body, like shredded to pieces, she'd be like, she might still be alive. You know, like, I just, there was something about the way Spock was shutting everything down, the simulations failing. And then she didn't really have, like, if you're going to fudge the numbers, there's got to be some verifiable hope. But she was simply going on a notion, on a hunch that wasn't really well-founded. I understand Uhura's dogged desire to help a friend, a fellow bridge crewman. I even understand Pike going anyway despite the numbers. but I just don't feel again like any of it was earned. And that did kind of get to me. And then, yeah, at the end when Pike's like, well, you violated Starfleet protocol, deceived me, and put the ship and all of its crew, plus the pandemic people, you know, all in danger. But good job, soldier. You know, I was a little like, oh, Christopher.
Yeah.
Christopher, this is why you wind up in an industrial accident.
Like, so I agree with that last part, and I'll come to it for sure. But the Uhura doggedness thing, I almost see it differently in that, like, it bugged me that no one else was also pushing for it. Like, I totally get Uhura, and like, to her, that transmission, she was convinced it was from the other side of the wormhole for reasons, and no one else seemed like willing to engage with the possibility, I guess.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it became very much Uhura against everybody. My problem with that came that no one else was on Uhura's side. Like, I feel like, because she was ultimately right? Like, so I don't know. I didn't have a problem with her being so gung-ho about it. I had a problem with everyone else kind of not really backing her, except for Pike and Spock, I guess, as well, in the science lab, eventually comes around to, like, all right, we'll do another simulation.
Yeah. I think it would have played better if, and like, I'm going to mention something else in a minute too, about how things could have played better. I feel like Uhura could have even put her thumb on the pad, and then Pike could have been like, Lieutenant Uhura, don't make a mistake you'll regret. We're going anyway. Mm-hmm. You know, something like that would be, you know, maybe a little more captainy rather than, well, you deceived the entire crew, but that's okay. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. That, yeah, see, that way I think works really well. I reminded again of how Una responded to what Ortegas did, and in that same episode, how Pike responded to M'Benga. And we're just seeing this pattern of Pike really being lenient. Like, and I know a lot of people will defend this and say, well, look at, you know, Kirk breaking the rules and all that kind of stuff.
Or Janeway,
right. But if you think about it, for the most part, like, let's look at Kirk specifically. That was the exception. That was not the rule. If you watch TOS, he very much is an officer and a gentleman. And you know, when he takes matters into his own hands, it's because, you know, he's out of contact with Starfleet, or they haven't given him orders yet, and he has to figure out a situation, yada, yada, yada. Mm-hmm. The big one, of course, Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, stealing the Enterprise. And that wasn't the norm for Kirk at the time. That was a maverick move that, like, got him charged with a bunch of stuff. Like, people remembering the original Star Trek will think of Kirk as a rule breaker, a womanizer, and like, no, not really. Like, it was very much, he was very much an officer and followed the rules, and, you know, would discipline his officers when they disobeyed orders or ignored rules or took shortcuts and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I don't like this pattern that's emerging where, and I mean, recently with some friends over, we watched the first two episodes of season two.
Yeah.
And we kind of figured out where Pike got it from, because Bob April basically forgave Spock for stealing the Enterprise, and he prevented a war with the Klingons, but it might not have gone that way, right? So
consider your hangover punishment. Are you kidding, April? Right. You just stole the flagship of the Federation. You're like, well, you know, you got a headache, so, you know, good enough.
Yeah, we know where Pike got it for sure.
Oh, lordy.
Yeah, and it's a little bit, I wonder if the writers are establishing a little bit of a pattern here where Pike is getting into this headspace where he's only got 9 years of life left anyway. So is that too dark? I don't know. Like, is that maybe where they're kind of going with this? Because he seems very cavalier, more cavalier than he used to be even.
Yeah. Well, they'd better go somewhere with it, because if not, it does seem a little, it smacks a little bit of incompetence of like, you need to discipline your crew sometimes. It happens, right? You know, we watched Master and Commander the Far Side of the World, and when that guy fails to salute, he gets 12 lashes, and they're all like, how could you do that, blah, 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 and that's what Captain Aubrey says. He's like, I will have order on this ship. Mm-hmm. Like, that's the way it goes. And I mean, I really don't like the concept of corporal punishment to begin with.
Oh, of course not, yeah.
But, you know, when you think about the context of 1805 stuck in the Pacific gyre and everyone's blaming someone for them being there, you got to do something, right? Mm-hmm. And so in this case, even still, you know, either he catches her, if he already knew, he should have caught her in the moment and stopped her from making that decision, or he should have said, I understand why you did that. I'm glad we found Ortegas. You have 2 weeks on probation or something, mm-hmm. right? This is going on your Starfleet record, something yeah. had to have been done, but instead he just blows it off and not my cup of tea. But I yeah. think, again, I wouldn't necessarily blame Chris as much as I would say a few things get swept up pretty fast here, especially in the end.
I want to talk one more last thing about Uhura, because another episode we watched in that batch was Ad Aspera per Aspera.
Yes.
So the same character is approached. Uhura is approached by La'an and says, please turn over any communications regarding Una to me. And Uhura's like, yep, no problem. And she says, and any personal logs mentioning it as well. And she's like, no, I can't do that. And they get into it a little bit, and she says, you know, if I follow an illegal order, all that's going to happen is we're both going to get into trouble, and I'm not going to do that, and I can't do that to you. So yeah. No, I will not do that. And that's Uhura following the letter of the law, the rules. And I'm like, this Uhura now,
yeah.
As Pike says, that's a new one for you, Uhura. And I wish he'd left it with, you know, don't do this again, rather than like, it's okay, it's for the right reasons. It's like, oh my God, no. Anyway, that's the last I'm going to say about that. That's literally the only thing that bugged me about this episode. I'm going to be honest.
Yeah, well, it's been bugging us a little over the last season. And I would say, you know, like, it's not to say like this hasn't been a good season. I've really enjoyed it so mm-hmm. far. But that little, it's just a little knot in the rug for us, I find.
Yeah, definitely. The end. They're propping open this wormhole. They're scanning. They're checking all these moons. They don't have time to check them all. They're just going to scan the closest ones and hope they get lucky. Meanwhile, on the moon, there's this plan, basically, that when the gas giant's atmosphere comes into contact, it's going to cause the air to become flammable. Erica finds this out through an accident kind of thing. And so she's going to ignite a thruster pack, basically, that's going to cause the atmosphere of this moon to ignite and send up a rescue flare, basically. I did love the back and forth between her and the Gorn. Yeah. Disagree. It's like, this is a good plan. Disagree. But eventually, you know, she does help out with it, even though she still thinks it's crazy and they're going to die kind of thing.
Yeah.
I really like that. And then the reversal where Erica starts to give up and, you know, the Gorn comes and with her hand and that was lovely for sure.
Yeah. Do you ever do that? And I really, honestly, listeners, viewers, please do not try this at home. I am saying this as a thing that I did stupidly as a youngster, a teenager, was sometimes if you have like a flannel shirt like this, and there's an extra bit of lint on it, you can light a match and it'll burn only the top of it, and it kind of moves up the fabric. I feel like the effect kind of looked like that, and it brought me back to my stupid days as a 12-year-old who was able to get a hold of a lighter, and thankfully I did not harm myself or anyone or anyone's property in the process, but it was a good effect.
Yeah, very similar actually to if you live in an area with a lot of poplar trees, or as you might know them, aspen trees. If you get the fluff along the ground, again, do not do this. I'm saying this looking out my window right now and seeing like such a thick blanket of smoke that I can barely see the house across the street.
Go outside today.
The fires around here, well, actually up north, that we're getting the smoke from are so bad right now. So do not do this. But I have seen video of that layer of poplar aspen fluff, the pollen, burning away across the ground, and very similar, just this expanding kind of line of fire as it burns away, and hopefully catches nothing else on fire on the way. But you know, don't try that, please.
Yeah.
So I'm anticipating what we're going to be talking about here, because just to set it up, on the bridge, they've reached the red line, they're about to leave, and a moon starts going up in flames, and you see it wrap around the planet, and immediately Uhura goes, that's Erica, and even Una says, only Erica or Tagus would blow up an entire planet's atmosphere to signal for help, and they're like, that's her, yep, really?
After all of that, well, this is improbable. This is not possible. There is no way. We can't be sure. All that stuff I feel like this could have been fixed with like another 30 seconds of dialogue of like, what was that? Oh my gosh, that seems very, you know, like Spock could turn and be like,
there's no natural phenomenon that I'm detecting that could cause this.
Yeah. And then, throw the scanners on it and then be like, I'm detecting two life signs. One of them is clearly human, right?
Yeah.
We're good.
Or like, or even like duranium hull from a shuttle wreckage, like something, right?
Anything yeah. other than magic.
It's her. It's definitely her.
Yeah, I just feel like there was a little bit of laziness there that really kind of suspends the disbelief to some degree, right? Again, what happens on the moon is interesting and fun. And yeah, the disagree when Artakis is running out to manually start that thing.
Yeah.
You know, obviously, you know, she's going to be fine, all this sort of stuff. But the way Melissa Navia plays it out, it is acrobatic. It's fun. It's very Artakis, right? And then for them to be like, oh, that's Artakis for you, blowing up, blah, 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 blah. It's like, can we not cartoonify this, please? That definitely got my goat a little more than it should, but that gets changed quite quickly with the sadness afterward.
Definitely. So yeah, they send a landing party down to rescue her, Lon and a security team. By the way, this is the shot. I don't know what it was, but there was kind of an overhead view of them beaming in with the way they cast the light or something. It felt like a set just for like half a second. That's the only shot. I don't know why, just something. But anyway, so this landing party beams down. They see Artagis emerge from this makeshift shelter, and then a huge hulking Gorn follows her immediately. And unfortunately, you know exactly what's happening next. Lon orders the team to open fire and they kill the Gorn. I think interestingly set up by the line in We Are Starfleet, where she says that when her people are in danger, she will fire first, even though Starfleet doesn't fire first, is what I think Georgiou says in the first episode of Discovery, right? So, yeah. The visceral pain in Ortegas's voice as she's yelling no, and why did you do that? And
yeah,
that was heartbreaking. And then the camera keeps going back to her dead body lying on the ground. It's just, wow. That was, I'm so emotionally attached to this puppet. It's so good.
Well, and the Gorn, when she does die, it's a puppet. They must have helped with CGI, but they're just sort of like a look of satisfied resignation a little bit as well, I found, of like, yep, this is how it's got to be kind of thing. Like they're, I can tell she didn't die kind of bitterly, right? And I mean, again, you know, some people might ask, like, well, wouldn't they hesitate? You know, clearly this Gorn was on the same moon, blah, 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 all this sort of stuff. Given the hostility of the Gorn so far, if I saw one, I'd fire immediately. I wouldn't, I would not hesitate for a single solitary second. So I don't fault Lon for firing first, right? Gorn have been nothing but hostile so far. There's no other way to parse that out.
Yeah. And it's sad all around. Like it's a tragedy in the making, right? Like it's one of those things where you're watching and you're seeing the pieces move to get towards each other and you know what's going to happen. It's like when you reread the, I think it's book 2 of A Song of Ice and Fire, and you're begging Rob and his people not to go to the frays because you know the Red Wedding is coming.
Yeah.
But they do it anyway. Every time I read that book, they still do it.
I know. It doesn't make any sense. It doesn't make any sense why they do that sort of thing.
But that's it, right? We all beam up and everybody, that's the end, I think. Wait. I feel like somebody altered my memory of this for some reason. There's something niggling there.
Yeah, I feel like there's like a blip in the transporter, like everything kind of stopped for a second.
So that moment, by the way, where like Ortegas looks crazy, right? Yeah. She's yelling at like, there's this light and it's been watching her and show yourselves. And why did you do this? What was this all for? And Lon whips out her communicator and says, Enterprise, beam us up now.
Yeah.
And everything freezes mid transport.
Yeah.
That was such a cool moment.
Love the effect.
Yeah. And so this light that's been watching starts coming down. And for half a second, I was like, ooh, is my Rhys Darby theory gonna... And then before it even appeared, I was like, no, wait. This is the Metrons.
Yeah, you shouted it. I was like, Dan! Yeah, you're right!
And so those of you who may or may not remember the TOS episode Arena, the previous appearance of the Gorn in Star Trek history, this is the species, the kind of seemingly very all-powerful species that pits Captain Kirk against the Gorn at the end of that episode and gives them their arena to demonstrate what humanity has learned or all this kind of stuff. And here, Terrarium, right? This is the Metron Terrarium versus the arena. And this encounter has been engineered by the Metrons to study two barbaric races, both bent on killing the other, is how they put it. You're both primitive, savage races who are intent on annihilating one another. Which I love that language, equating the two of us. Not one isn't more aggressive than the other. We're both bloodthirsty, trying to kill each other kind of thing.
Yeah.
And trying to see if the two of them could work together. But interestingly, it's Lon's actions that make them rethink all of this and say like, well, maybe more experiments are required. Which tells me like it was Lon killing the Gorn that were like, well, let's engineer the Kirk-Gorn thing later.
Yeah,
which
well,
is
exactly. Yeah, I appreciated their addition. I enjoyed their characterization as well. There's a nice kind of modern touch to them that I quite enjoyed. And I guess it makes sense. And I think this is where we get that concept of terrarium versus arena, right? Like a terrarium is an experimental place, and arena is a place you fight.
Yeah. Yeah, I liked that naming scheme. Thing there. And yeah, the kind of androgyny of the Metron as they're speaking, and there's kind of a male coded and a female coded voice that are at various times ascendant as they're speaking, which is interesting. I recently just put on like the last 10 minutes of Arena the other day, and very much a 1960s perception of what androgyny and like sexlessness would be, right?
Yeah.
Or a non-binary through the lens of 1960s television absolutely was what the Metron was presented as in that episode as well. So that was interesting. I liked how they did that for sure.
Yeah. Well, again, this indicates to me that we're, I mean, almost certainly going to be seeing the Metrons again before the end of this series. Mm-hmm. And I mean, I don't know. It would be interesting. Like, I wonder what they did after the burn.
Huh. Yeah, definitely.
Who knows?
I feel like there's at least an Easter egg at some point that there's like a cargo container in Deep Space Nine that's like addressed to the Metrons or something. So like, I don't know. In Arena, they say perhaps in 1,000 years you'll be ready to make contact. And Kirk tells this to Spock on the bridge that they said this. And I wonder if Spock in the back of his mind was thinking, oh, maybe my sister will be the one to make contact. That's about how far forward she went, isn't it?
There we go. Have fun with the mic. But... yeah, interesting.
There's also one line here that like I loved. And I'm still not entirely sure what it means. It could mean a couple of things, but the Metron is saying, you know, further experiments are necessary, and we may have to one day alter your perception of the Gorn.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess, because obviously Ortegas's view of the Gorn will change quite a bit. And I mean, to the point that if she encounters a Gorn pilot in battle, it might stay her hand a little.
Mm-hmm.
And that could affect the crew. That could affect the safety of her ship. A lot of those sorts of things, right? Like, I do have to say, like, I mean, I think it really helped her manage through a ton of trauma. But yeah, that godlike, well, we're just going to have to fiddle with your brain a little bit to get you back in there. Like the Men in Black flash thing.
Yeah. Kinda. I wonder if, like, you could take it literally as well. Like, the next time you see the Gorn, you won't see them as the, like, crazy big lizard things. They'll be, like, you know, standing upright and looking like they're in a rubber suit and moving slowly.
I mean, that's possible.
I don't know. I just thought that was a fascinating line and definitely put there for people like me who have been like, but the Gorn in the original series and they're not acting the same way. Yeah. Okay. All right. Kind of similar feeling to like, we'll have to delete all references to the Discovery from the historical record and stuff. Kind of along that same lines, but with like godlike power behind it.
So. Yeah. A Simpsons, and let us never speak of this again.
Yeah. Interesting. The final scene between Ortegas and Uhura I liked, where, you know, they're talking about what it took to get her back and all that kind of stuff. But also the one line I loved where she's talking about the Gorn and she says, she was my friend.
Yeah.
Lon is also my friend. I don't know what to do with that. Yeah. And yeah, like I feel that, right? Like that was the, and Uhura, when she says they were both doing what they could to protect you, you know?
Yeah. And I guess like, it's a hard pill to swallow, but I do have to say like Lon, given all of her context, there would have been no way in the time they had for Ortegas to have explained anything. There is a, you know, like it would be like if you and I were on a hiking trip and we were separated for like a day and you made friends with a bear. And as the bear's coming up from behind you, I would whip out my bear spray and spray the crap out of that bear in order to save you. And no amount of, hold on, Barry, would I stop before I would attack that thing because it's a bear. Yeah. You know, it is this idea of like, Lon is a stone cold killer. But also she cares about her friends, and given all of her context, anytime the Gorn have been present, it's been a fight. So,
And not to mention that, you know, the aggression of the Gorn defined the first half of her life too.
Like, right?
Like not just as security officer of the Enterprise, but as a formative, this is a force of nature who destroys and kills, right?
Like exactly.
That, yeah. There's no realistic way that could have gone differently, sadly.
No, I don't think so either. So as much as I know Ortegas could be, you know, mad about the circumstances, I don't think it makes sense to be mad at Lon about it.
I don't think you could help it, but yeah.
Not at all.
Well, other little bits, the kind of bring out your dead part of the episode, just little things from this episode that I enjoyed. The ship that they have to rendezvous with is the USS Constellation. And when it's first mentioned, I was like, oh, I wonder if Commodore Decker is aboard.
No.
Apparently not. Captain Decker is in command. So he's not promoted to Commodore yet. But I love that little just continuity touchstone there. That was nice.
We don't get to see him or anything, but it is nice to know that he's out there.
Yeah.
Doing his thing.
And we do know from an episode of Discovery that he's one of the top decorated captains in the history of Starfleet as well. So
Yeah, no, I appreciated that quite a bit. I don't know. I've noticed that it feels like, and maybe I'm just not seeing it right. I just feel like the ceiling on the bridge of the Enterprise has been getting higher this season. Especially when we watched a few of the season two episodes, I just feel like they've kind of raised the ceiling a little bit. And maybe that's just something that I'm going to kind of try to look at as we look at both seasons.
Interesting.
Moving forward. Yeah. It's just a little personal, my own little bring out your dead there.
Okay.
Yeah.
Cool. The last thing I want to mention, and this is actually, they did this in the last episode, but I didn't catch it watching it. They added the Jakaru, the yeah. spacefaring creature, to the opening credits that first appeared, of course, in the episode What is Starfleet? But in the opening credits, it first showed up in last week's Four and a Half Vulcans. So it continues to be here this week. So it's a new addition to the credits.
Yeah. In our defense, we were laughing hysterically when we... When Four and a Half Vulcans were happening, because Pike was doing his Vulcan Space the Final Frontier, and that had us in stitches.
Yes. Well, anything that we haven't talked about that you want to mention for this episode before we wrap this up?
No, but I think this falls in, like, you know, you'd said, you know, this falls in sort of like the classic Star Trek trope of getting stranded somewhere with an enemy and finding friendship. And you know, I mean, this thing, this just keeps coming around. I do think that when we think of Star Trek not as a exploration of the universe and new life and new civilizations, but actually an exploration of the human condition, I think this is something that we really do need to take to heart when we think about othering people, when, you know, you think about what's happening, maybe not to the same extent, obviously, in Canada, but in our neighbor's place down south there, where people are being pulled off the streets for just slightly looking different and stuff like that. The dehumanization that can happen when you do kind of fall into sort of an ideological stance on the other, and how honestly it's complete folly, and it's a conceit that leads to the destruction of our society and possibly worse. So, you know, if you do hate another group of people for some certain reason, understand that the enemy's story is often a lot like mine, and if it's possible, you know, maybe we can find other ways to solve our differences and find humanity wherever it may be.
Absolutely. Perfectly put, for sure. To me, this episode is another top one of the season, possibly mm-hmm. the series for me. My only bugbears, I guess, were the Uhura and flouting of regulations, and the way she's just kind of let to get away with it there was a little annoying, but I still feel like that's maybe part of an ongoing thread that we're going to pluck at some point. So
at this point, it's got to be. If not, I'm going to be very disappointed in the writers, but I know they've so far held true to a lot of stuff that I think we've been expecting. So that's good.
Yeah. For sure. So yeah, top marks for me generally mm-hmm. for this episode. My favorite of the season and the series is still the Saylot Who Ate Its Tail. But this is up there. This is a really good one as well. Strong season so far, with mm-hmm. only one stumble so far, in my opinion. But yeah.
Yeah, and it's a stumble that I'll give a gimme to be honest. Maybe I'm evoking my inner Pike and being like, it's okay. So... Yeah.
Oh yeah. No, I'm not like I hate it or anything, but yeah. Anyway, we spoke about that last week. Don't worry about that. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you all so much for joining us this week. Please join the conversation, positivelytrek@gmail.com. If you'd like to email us, or in the Positively Trek discussion group on Facebook, we'd love to hear from you. Thank you once again for tuning in. We'll see you next week for the season finale, which I can't believe it's already here. But that episode is New Life and New Civilizations. And we'll be here talking about it with all of you. So thanks again. Live long and prosper, and stay positive. Positively Trek is produced and edited by me, Dan Gunther, and co-produced by Barry DeFord on Treaty 8 territory, the home of the Beaver, Cree, Dene, and Métis people, whose histories, languages, and cultures we respect. We acknowledge the many First Nations, Métis, and Inuit who have lived in and cared for these lands for generations.